coarse, thick timbers. There were plenty of defenders on that long wall. Too many. But I had promised C. Trigger to do my best to draw men from the rampart he was assaulting, and it was time to keep that promise. C. Trigger's men were crossing the ditches, assailed by spears, trying to protect themselves with shields made even more unwieldy by the spears lodged in the willow boards. I could hear Svart shouting them forward. It was a struggle. The ditches were deep, and the banks between the ditches were steep and slippery. Two of Skull's men were in the short tower at the fort's corner, and were hurling spears that were being handed up to them from inside the fort. "Guthwulf!" I called him back. "You can kill those two bastards!" Guthwulf selected an arrow, notched it on the string, took a deep breath, drew his short bow, held his breath, and loosed. The closest man on the tower was about to hurl a spear, and the arrow struck him on the helmet. He jerked back, turned, and the second arrow pierced his nose. He sank down, clutching the wound. The other man ducked behind the parapet, and Guthwulf grunted. "I meant to kill them both." "You did well," I said, then saw that C. Trigger's wall had crossed 5 of the 7 ditches. "Time to go," I thought. I'd never felt so little enthusiasm for a battle. Even the thought of revenging Stiora's death left me cold. It was the curse, I thought, and I remembered Snorri's prophecy of the two kings dying, and I drew serpent breath, tried to forget the curse, and shouted at my men to follow. And on that hill of death, we went to the ramparts. "Now they go forth, birds screeching. The grey wolf howls, the shield wood clashes, shield answers shaft. Wake now, my warriors. Grasp shields, be strong in valour. Fight your way forward." "I never told them to be strong in valour," I said. "There's no point in saying something like that. You can't make a man brave by shouting at him." "It's a..." the young priest began. "A poem," I said. "I know." I smiled. I liked Father Selwyn. "Bravery is overcoming fear," I said. "And I don't know how you do that. Duty helps a little, experience, of course, and not letting down your comrades helps a lot, but really, bravery is a kind of madness."
"Madness, Lord?"
"It seems as if you're watching yourself. You can't believe what you're doing. You know you might die, but you keep doing it. Battle madness. It's what the Ulfhethnar have, but they use henbane or ale or mushrooms to fill them with the madness, but we all have some of it. If we didn't, we'd simply give in to the fear." He frowned.
"Are you saying..."
He hesitated, not sure if he should speak what was on his mind.
"Are you saying you are frightened, Lord?"
"Of course I was frightened," I admitted. "I was terrified. We were fighting the wrong battle in the wrong place. Skald had planned it well. He let us come. He didn't interfere with us as we approached. He wanted us to come to his walls and to be slaughtered in his ditches, and like fools, we did just what he wanted. I knew we would lose."
"You knew?"
he began to ask. "But we still had to fight," I interrupted him. "We couldn't retreat, not without being pursued and harried and killed, so we had to try to win. That's fate. But yes, I knew we would lose. We'd made a mistake and we were doomed, but there's only one way out of a mess like that. You have to fight your way out of it." We went forward, and, as I told Father Selwyn, I felt doomed. We were advancing down the side of the fort, which meant that once we had crossed the place where the ditches and banks turned around the tower, we were walking along the ridges, not across them, which made our advance quicker. We went in a rush, and I remember being surprised that it suddenly seemed so easy. Spears came from our right, but they rattled or thumped on our shields, and then we turned, crossed 2 ditches, and closed on the wall. Then it stopped being easy. "Axes!" I shouted. I had given our biggest and strongest men the long-hafted axes with their broad blades and deep lower beards. Each shaft was as long as a spear, which made the weapons clumsy. But my men had learned how they were to be used. My front rank stood with me under the ramparts, and the North hammered our raised shields with spears and axes. The wall was not much higher than a man, which meant the defenders were close and their blows heavy. I felt my shield splintering as the axe blades crashed into the boards. The Norse had seen us coming, had seen the gold around my neck, the arm rings glittering, and the silver on my helmet. They knew I was a lord, and they wanted the reputation of killing me. I could not fight back. To lower the shield so that I could lunge up with Serpent Breath's long blade would expose me to the defenders, which meant our duty, the front rank's duty, was to stand in the sloppy mud of the ditch and keep those defenders busy by making ourselves into easy targets. And behind us, the big men with the strangely long axes struck. Those men, like Gebrut and Folkbold, both Frisians, let the axes fall over the defenders and then hauled them back, using the long spiked beard of the blade to gaff the enemy like fish. The heavy blows on my shield ended as the first axe blows landed. I heard a shout from above, then blood splashed on my splintered shield and some dripped through a split in the wood. There was another bellow from above me, and a Norseman came tumbling over the rampart to fall at my feet. Vidar Leifsson, beside me, stabbed down with his short sea axe. The man jerked like a landed fish and then died. I remember the man dying, and then little more. My axes were working, at least until Skull's men learned to hack at the long shafts with their own axes, but every man we killed or wounded on the wall was immediately replaced by another, and it was one of those newcomers who hurled down a great block of stone that shattered my weakened shield and struck the left side of my helmet. I showed the battered helmet to the poet. "See the gash?" Father Selwyn fingered the metal that had split where the stone had crushed the helmet.
"That must have hurt, Lord."
I laughed. I had a headache for days after, but at the time it didn't hurt. I was knocked unconscious. Father Selwyn ran an ink-stained finger across the scar that disfigured the silver wolf that crested the helmet.
"You never had it repaired, Lord?"
"It's a reminder of my stupidity," I said, making the young man smile. "And I have other helmets."
"Were you attacking the Northern Tower when it happened?"
"We hadn't got that far. The idea was to draw men away from that corner." Like almost everything else that day, the plan to weaken the northern corner by attacking the southwestern angle of the fort did not work. Skoll had crammed a small army into Heber, and he had no need to weaken any part of his ramparts. All he had to do was let us make futile attacks on his walls until we finally abandoned the assaults, and then pursue us to destruction. That had been his plan ever since he had withdrawn from Bevanburg, and like fools, we obliged him. My attack on the northern stretch of wall failed. We lost another 7 men. Skoll lost 2 men. We had 16 wounded, including myself, and Skoll had maybe a half dozen injured at the most. I did not see our retreat from the walls and its ditches. I was unconscious. I had been struck by the lump of stone that splintered my shield and split my helmet. I fell, and Finan later told me how Gebrut and Edric seized my arms, rescued Serpent Breath, and dragged me back. A spear struck my left thigh while they hauled me over the banks. The blade cut deep, but I was unaware of it. Finan tried to keep the men at the wall, tried to gaff yet another Norseman and haul him down to the inner ditch, but when my men saw me being pulled back to the safer ground beyond the ditches, they lost heart. They retreated with me, pursued by Norse jeers and thrown spears. At first, as I recovered, the only thing I was aware of was the triumphant shouts of a victorious enemy. They bellowed their insults, blew horns and clattered swords against shields as they invited us back to the ramparts. Seatrigger's bigger assault, like mine, had also been driven back, and Skoll's men were mocking us.
"I never even planted one ladder," Seatrigger told me later. "There were too many of the bastards."
The next thing I remember is the sharp pain as Vidar pulled off my damaged helmet.
"Christ, be careful!"
Finan snarled at him, as blood flowed from my scalp. He poured water on my head.
"Lord! Lord!"
I must have mumbled something because I remember Vidar's surprised words.
"He's alive!"
"Take more than a bloody rock to kill him," Finan said. "Bandage his head. You, girl, come here."
"Girl," I muttered, but no one heard me. Elwina, one of Jeremias's angels, was evidently on the hilltop.
"Tear a strip off your gown," Finan ordered her, "and tie up his head."
"I'm all right," I said, and tried to sit up.
"Stay," Finan snarled at me as though I was one of his dogs. "Bind it tight, girl."
"She shouldn't be here,"
I said, or tried to say. I was gazing up at a clearing sky, though the left side of my sight was darkened. I flinched, suddenly aware of the pain in my skull.
"Where's my sword?"
I asked in panic.
"Safe in her scabbard, Lord," Finan said. "Now lie down and let the girl bandage you."
"I want to see,"
I said, and struggled up, hauling on Elwina's arm. She was surprisingly strong and managed to pull me into a sitting position. My sight was blurred, still dark on the one side, but I saw Jeremias had come with his angels. The mad bishop was in his embroidered robes, still carrying his crozier on which he had tied the ram's skull. He crouched in front of me and stared at me with his intense, dark eyes.
"The stone, Lord," he hissed. "We need the stone."
"Bugger off, bishop," Finan snarled.
"What's happening?"
I asked.
"You got a tap on the head."
Finan elbowed Jeremias aside.
"The stone!"
Jeremias insisted.
"Give me the stone or we lose!"
"He'll give you the stone when he's ready,"
Finan said, having no idea what he was talking about.
"Bind it tight, girl."
"I need a helmet," I said.
"The stone!"
Jeremias called again.
"Bishop," Finan said angrily. "Unless you want your two angels to spend the next month flat on their backs pleasuring Norsemen, you'd better go. Take them back to the horses, then go back home."
"I'm needed here,"
Jeremias said indignantly. My son pushed the bishop further away and stooped to me.
"Father, I'm all right,"
I said.
"He's not," Finan insisted.
"I need a helmet."
"Your day's done, Lord," Finan said. "A helmet!"
"Stay still, Lord,"
Elwina said. She finished bandaging my skull.
"Does it hurt, Lord?"
"Of course it bloody hurts," Finan said. "Now bandage his thigh."
"Seatrigger says we should attack again,"
my son said. Finan used a knife to cut open my breeches.
"Bind it tight, girl."
"We have to help Seatrigger," I said.
"You're doing nothing more, Lord," Finan said.
"I've done nothing yet,"
I said bitterly, and moaned as pain stabbed through my skull. I do not know how much time had passed. As I sat, half-stunned, trying to clear my sight, it seemed as if we had only just arrived and the fight had been as brief as it was disastrous. But the fog had cleared, the sky was blue, and the sun high. Horns were sounding from Seatrigger's ranks, men were cheering. Svart, huge and fearsome, was calling them back to the fight.
"We have to help them,"
my son said.
"Stay with your father," Finan said. "I'll lead this one."
"Finan,"
I called, and the effort provoked another lance of pain in my head.
"Lord,
be careful."
He laughed at that.
"Lord," he was talking to my son, "if your father can walk, get him downhill to the horses."
"We're not running away," I insisted.
"I'll come with you,"
my son began speaking to Finan.
"You stay," Finan ordered him sharply, "and get your father to the horses. You, girl, help him."
I waited for Finan to leave, tried to stand, and fell back, dizzy.
"We stay here," I growled.
And so I just watched the second assault on Skull's fortress, and it fared no better than the first. We had made such a mess of this fight. We had been impetuous, unwilling to wait, trusting to fate to see us across the ditches and over the wall, and fate had spat in our faces. The defenders were throwing more blocks of masonry pulled from the Roman ruins, and each was heavy enough to crush a skull. Finan, evidently abandoning our plan to attack the northern corner, had ordered Cuthwulf and his archers to harass the men defending the wall we had assaulted before, but most of the arrows were wasted on shields. I could see snarling wolf shields stuck with a score of arrows, and behind them the Norsemen hurled down stones or thrust with spears. Finan even managed to get one ladder against the wall, but before he or anyone could climb it, a man leaned down and swept it aside with an axe. Gebrut seized the man's arm and hauled him over the ramparts, and I saw my men's spears rising and falling in vengeance, but that was their one small victory. Skull's men gained a far greater triumph. Sigtryggr, filled with a battle fury born of desperation, had collected spears thrown from the ramparts and had 20 of his men hurling the weapons back at the defenders. I watched, impressed by the number of missiles his men were raining on the wall, and as the defenders crouched beneath their shields, Sigtryggr led a rush of men across the ditches. They carried two ladders that they rammed against the wall. A brave Norseman leaned down to throw one ladder aside and succeeded before a spear raked into his shoulder. The ladder fell, but Sigtryggr was already mounting the second ladder when Svart unceremoniously threw him off the lower rungs and climbed himself. He swung his huge axe one-handed, driving back two defenders. I could hear Svart bellowing, hear Sigtryggr yelling at his men to put the first ladder back, saw the spears still flying at the ramparts, and Svart was almost at the short ladder's top, flailing his axe. He was a huge man, terrifying, and the defending Norsemen were backing away from that massive blade as Svart climbed another rung, was almost over the wall, and then the ladder's rung snapped. He jarred down, almost fell, and had to reach out with his axe to steady himself, and a Norse defender darted forward and rammed a spear at Svart's neck. The defender was immediately struck by a thrown spear and fell out of sight, but not before his long blade had pierced Svart's throat. I could see the sudden blood. Somehow Svart stayed upright, swaying. He tried to lift the axe, but another defender, screaming defiance, swung a sword that bit into the bleeding wound, and Svart, a warrior of 100 victories, fell back into the ditch. The death of Svart gave the defenders new confidence and drained Sigtryggr's men of their defiance. I did not know it, but Sigtryggr had also been wounded. A spear had bitten into his shoulder. His men pulled him back, and Finan, seeing the retreat of that larger group, called an end to his own futile attack. Skull's men were laughing again, cheering, calling us cowards, inviting us to surrender and telling us they would enjoy our women and enslave our children. Skull himself came to the wall the first time I'd seen him that day, and he stood massive in his white fur cloak that he wore above his shining mail. His helmet, I saw, was ringed with a circlet of gold, his sign of kingship. He mocked us.
"Have you had enough? You want to come to my wall again? You'll be welcome. If you try harder, maybe I'll have to wake some of my other warriors."
One of Sigtryggr's men threw a spear, and Skull took one contemptuous sideways step so that the weapon flew past him.
"You have to do better than that," he called.
He was searching the hundreds of men gathered on the far side of the ditches.
Is Sigtryggr Ivarsson here?
No one answered, and Skoll laughed, still searching among his enemies. Then he saw me, sitting off to one side. He pointed.
The old man's here. Are you hurt, old man?
Get me up, I growled, and my son gave me his arm, and I forced myself up. I swayed. My head hurt, but I stayed on my feet.
Don't die, Lord Uhtred, Skoll shouted. I want to kill you myself. I will add your head and your banner to the trophies in my hall.
His ramparts were crowded. His men were grinning and laughing. We were beaten, and Skoll knew it.
But don't go away yet, he called. Stay an hour or so, and I'll wake up my Ulfhjelmar.
He laughed again, then went from the parapet. And I knew it could only get worse. The Ulfhjelmar would be unleashed to crown Skoll's victory, and two kings would die. Chapter 12
Many a carcass they left to be carrion, left for the white-tailed eagle to tear it, and left for the horny-nibbed raven to rend it, and gave to the scavenging war-hawk to gorge it, and that grey beast, the wolf...
I had to smile.
Horny-nibbed raven. You think it should be horny-beaked, Lord?
Father Selwyn asked anxiously.
You're the poet, I said, not me.
I remembered the ravens flying up from the Tyne Valley, hosts of black wings in a dread morning, coming to the feast we were preparing for them.
But I didn't see any wolves, I told the young priest, except, of course, for the Ulfhjelmar.
So, Skoll? He said, sent his Ulf...
He paused, uncertain of the word again.
His Ulfhjelmar.
His Ulfhjelmar to fight you, Lord?
I nodded.
We didn't think he would, at least not while we were so close to his walls.
Why not, Lord?
He had us beaten. We had a choice. Either we assaulted again and more of our men would die, or else we ran away.
That would be the time for Skoll to let loose his savages.
When he said he'd wake up his Ulfhjelmar, we thought he was just trying to frighten us, trying to persuade us to give up and retreat down the hill.
I closed my eyes, imagining. Can you understand what would have happened? I asked the poet. Broken men, wounded men, defeated men, stumbling down a steep hillside, pursued by the wolf fighters. Our men would have panicked. It would have been a slaughter.
We almost gave Skoll the chance to inflict that slaughter. I was standing unsteadily, my sword arm around my son's shoulders, and still dazed when Sigtryggr came to find me. He walked slowly. There was blood on his left shoulder where his mail had been torn open, and his shield arm was hanging limp. He frowned when he saw me.
You're hurt, he said.
I was wearing a dead man's helmet that had blood on its rim.
So are you, Lord King.
Spear thrust, he said dismissively. You can still hold a shield. He shook his head, then turned to look at the fort.
It's a bastard,
he said quietly, and I knew that was an admission of failure.
It is, I agreed.
He paused.
Svart's dead.
I know, I saw. Sigtryggr's one good eye gleamed.
He was a good man. The best.
He was.
He died holding his axe.
So, we'll meet in Valhalla.
We will,
he said.
And maybe sooner than we want.
He offered me a skin.
There's no ale left, so it's water.
He watched me drink.
So what do we do?
I winced as a pain seared through my skull.
Try again. The northern corner.
as your madman suggested.
If you bring your men around to this side, I suggested, I can take mine to the northern corner.
Not many arrows left,
my son muttered. Seatrigger looked at the bodies we had left in the ditch. He grimaced. A Norseman to taunt us was standing on the rampart pissing on our dead.
The bastard,
Seatrigger said quietly. Behind us, on the rising ground, our wounded were lying in pain. A boy, one of those who had helped carry the ladders up to the fort, was weeping over his dying father. Seatrigger flinched, then looked back to the ramparts.
He has too many men, he said, and he hasn't moved anyone from that far corner.
Which meant our efforts to persuade Skoll to weaken the north, to reinforce the west, had failed. We can't leave, I said. They'll cut us down like sheep.
They will, he agreed, but we might have to.
No, I said as forcefully as I could. We have to attack. Seatrigger tried to move his shield arm and flinched at the pain.
And if another attack fails?
He asked. It mustn't fail, I said, because if it does, we're doomed. Seatrigger appeared not to hear those words, which were, I admit, little more than dutiful. I might sound defiant, but at that moment both of us knew we were doomed. He had turned to look back the way we had come in the morning's fog, a fog that had utterly vanished.
I'm thinking, he said, that if we make a shield wall across the track, then we can send away the men we want to save, like your son.
No!
My son began.
Quiet!
Seatrigger snarled at him and then turned back to me.
We make one long shield wall, and that should hold up their pursuit long enough.
You should leave too, I said. He scoffed at that suggestion.
I failed. I can't run away and leave my men to die.
He looked again at the fort.
I'll send a dozen good men to take my children to Bebbanburg. Your son can protect them there.
He will, I said.
I remember the chill wind blowing across the spur, as I realized that this was the place where my life thread would be severed. Two kings must die, and I, the king without a crown, was one of them. I touched the hammer and thought how I had let down my daughter. I had come for revenge, and I was failing. I could see my men gazing at me, wanting me to lead them to a surprise victory. They had an absurd faith in me.
"We've been at the arse end of fate before,"
I had heard Edric telling Imma Hergilson, the young man I had saved from hanging at Manchester.
"And he always gets us out. Don't worry, lad. We have Lord Uhtred. We'll win."
Except I knew of no way to win. We had been fools to assault the fort, and now we must take the bitter consequences. Seatrigger knew it too.
"So, we make the shield wall?"
he asked bleakly. "If Skoll sees men slipping away," I pointed out, "he'll send horsemen after them. They'll ride around our shield wall and kill the men we send away." Seatrigger knew I was right, but knew, as I did, that we could do nothing about that threat.
"We must try,"
was all he could say. And then the gate opened. We were standing on the rising ground to the west of the ramparts, and could look down on the fort's long side towards the northern corner that Jeremias had encouraged us to assault. Two-thirds of the way down that wall was one of Heber's three remaining gates, and it swung open. For a moment no one appeared there. We just stared, waiting. Then there was an unearthly scream, and Snorri, the sorcerer, appeared on the earthen causeway that crossed the ditches. Seatrigger and I both touched our hammers, while Finan and my son clutched at their crosses. Heber's hillspur went silent after the scream, because blind Snorri's appearance had ended the jeering from the ramparts, and the defenders just watched as as the sorcerer was guided across the ditches by his small white dog. Then, as he stopped and faced us, Snorri seemed to be gazing at us, while his small dog wagged its stubby tail. I remember that. It seemed so unnatural in that place of death, a little dog's tail wagging.
"Who is that?"
one of Seatrigger's men asked.
"His Galdra,"
my son answered quietly. "His sorcerer," I translated the Saxon word. Seatrigger touched the hammer again, then clutched it as Snorri slowly raised his wolf skull and pointed the muzzle towards us. I could see his mouth moving, and I supposed he was cursing us, though he was too far away for us to hear the curse. A man shouted from the ramparts and was silenced by his companions. Skull's men wanted to hear the curses that the dreaded Snorri cast on us.
"They say he can kill with a curse?"
Seatrigger asked. "If he can kill with a curse," I said, "why does Skull need warriors?" Seatrigger did not answer, but just kept holding his hammer as the small dog led Snorri closer to us. The sorcerer stopped, a long spear's throw away.
"Snorri is trying to frighten us," I said.
He was succeeding, too, and I could see him watching and smiling from the long rampart. Snorri began howling, and in between the shrieks and howls he hurled more curses. He was in earshot now, and he cursed us by land, by the sea, by the earth. He cursed us by fire, by water, by air. He gave our bodies to the corpse-ripper of Niflheim. He promised us an eternity of pain from Hel, the goddess of the rotting dead, and he raised the skull and his sightless eyes to the heavens and called on Thor to strike us and on Odin to blight us. Skull laughed with every phrase of the curse. He was in his great white cloak, pointing at us, talking to the men around him. He cupped his hands and shouted,
"You're all doomed! Snorri will kill you with his next curse!"
"They're just words," I shouted. But I could see that my men, even the Christians among them, were troubled by Snorri. They knew the gods controlled our fate, and knew that a sorcerer was closer to the gods than other men or women. And they had all heard the dread rumour that Skull's sorcerer could kill men at a distance, just by curses.
"They're just words,"
I called again, even louder. "Just nonsense." But I saw men making the sign of the cross or touching their hammers. Some began to edge away, and I knew our men trembled on the verge of a panicked flight. They could fight against men, but not against the gods. The Norse on the ramparts were jeering us again as Snorri seemed to take a deep breath, ready to launch his most powerful sorcery. Then Jeremiah leapt out in front of us. My immediate impulse was to pull him back, but Finan put a hand on my arm.
"Let him be, Lord, let him be."
Jeremias turned and hissed at me.
"Have the stone ready, Lord."
He looked back at Snorri, raised his arms, and screamed like a soul in torment. There was another silence after that scream. Skull's men were plainly surprised to see that we had a sorcerer too, and they went quiet, not in fear, but rather anticipating a battle of sorcerers. Both of them old, both white-haired and skinny, and both calling on the mysterious power of their god or gods. But Snorri, who had evidently expected no rival sorcerer, and who was astonished by Jeremias's scream, was momentarily speechless. Jeremias, meanwhile, appeared to be dancing. He was turning and leaping, singing in a high, crooning voice. There were no words, just the strange keening sound, as the fool, in his bishop's clothing, danced and twisted and capered towards Snorri.
"He's drunk,"
Seatrigger said.
"No," I answered. "He's used the ointment."
"Ointment?"
"The henbane. He thinks he's flying."
Jeremias suddenly crouched, then sprang up, arms wide.
"Thou tired of Satan!"
he shouted, pointing at Snorri. Then he loped towards the Norse sorcerer with his dirty bishop's robes trailing in the grass. He stopped some 20 paces short of Snorri, and lifted his crozier, on which the ram's skull was still perched.
"I curse you!"
he called in his native Danish, a language very close to the Norse tongue.
"By the power of Abraham's ram, I curse your head, I curse your hairs, I curse your eyes!"
"He doesn't have any eyes, you fool," I muttered.
"I curse your face, I curse your nose, I curse your serpent's tongue, I curse your teeth, I curse your neck, I curse your hands, I curse your belly, I curse your prick, I curse your arse."
He paused for breath. His words were slurred, but clear enough to every man in both armies.
"I curse every part of your foul being, from the hairs of your head to the soles of your feet. I curse your loathsome soul and consign it to the deepest pits of hell. I doom you to be torn apart by Lucifer's hounds. I condemn you to the torture of Satan's endless flames, to the perpetual agonies of eternity."
Snorri screamed back, calling on the frost giants of Niflheim to tear his rival limb from limb with their dread axes of ice.
"Let the god hear his screams,"
Snorri shouted as he raised his empty eyes to the sky.
"He is pus from the ass of the corpse-ripper, so let him be destroyed. I call on you, Odin. I call on you, All-Father. Kill him now! Kill him!"
He held his wolf-skull towards Jeremias, and for a heartbeat I held my breath, thinking to see the mad bishop fall. He did not fall.
"I live! I live! I live!"
Jeremias called triumphantly. He was capering again, the ram's skull teetering on the crook of his crozier. He went closer, much closer, to Snorri, still screaming.
"May worms gnaw your bowels and swine feed on your flesh. May cockroaches shit on your tongue. I curse you in the name of the Father. I doom you in the name of the Son, and I banish you from the living by the power of the Holy Ghost."
And on the last word, he jerked his crozier fast forward, swinging it down from high above his head until it pointed towards Snorri. I think the gesture was simply meant to point the ram's skull at Snorri, but such was the force of the swing that the horn skull flew from the crozier's tip and struck the pagan sorcerer on his breast. The blind Snorri staggered back, more surprised than hurt, and as he staggered he let go of the rope leash, and the little dog, yapping happily, ran to Jeremias, who seemed just as amazed as his rival.
"I win!"
he called, unable to hide his astonishment.
"God wins! The heathen is smitten!"
And Jeremias had indeed won. Snorri had been driven backwards, and instead of responding with a curse of his own, he was stooping and groping for his dog. But the dog had deserted Snorri and run to the mad bishop, who was cackling in triumph. And it was the dog's treachery that seemed to anger the watching Norsemen. They knew they were victorious that day, but Jeremias's triumph over Snorri was an insult to their pride. And suddenly the gate opened again, and a stream of warriors came across the causeway, while others leapt down from the wall. And almost every one of those warriors wore the grey wolfskin cape of the Ulfhednar.
"Shield wall!"
I shouted, and pain seared through my head.
"Shield wall now!"
Jeremias might have been half crazed by the henbane ointment, but he retained enough sense to flee when he saw the enemy warriors coming for him. He ran towards us with the small dog scampering beside him.
"The stone of David, Lord!"
he panted as he got nearer.
"Throw the stone now! For the living Christ's sake, throw the stone!"
I kicked the soil, and a scrap of stone, probably a chip from a block of Roman masonry, skidded away from my toe. I bent, picked it up, tried to ignore the stabbing pain in my head, and hurled the stone towards the enemy. Jeremias shouted as I threw the stone,
"We will win! We will win!"
He pushed his way between the shields of my front rank to find a safety that I feared was merely temporary. He stooped, picked up the small dog, and beamed at me.
"You believed me, Lord. The stone of David is cast. We will win."
But the Ofyevna were coming to kill us.
"Then carry your willow shields before you, and ring-mail coats too, and shining helmets into the crowd of foes. Slaughter their leaders with bright swords, their fated leaders, for your foes are doomed to die, and you shall have fame, glory in battle."
"I didn't say anything like that," I told the poet.
"Well, Lord..."
"It's a poem, I know."
"So what did you say to your men, Lord?"
"Probably something like kill the bastards, or keep the shields tight."
"You make speeches like that one," I tapped the parchment, "before a battle, not during it."
But Skull didn't give us time for speeches. Father Selwyn frowned.
"Jeremias," he said uncertainly.
He knew the mad bishop was a heretic, and he was uncomfortable talking about him.
"Had he used the henbane, Lord?"
"He stole it from my servant, and yes, he smeared it on his chest. He was shaking when he reached us, shivering and babbling. He collapsed behind us." I smiled, remembering the small dog licking the mad bishop's pale face. I'm not sure the poor man even knew what he'd just done. The priest frowned.
"He'd provoked an attack by the Ofyevna," he said disapprovingly.
"He had, yes."
"Did Skoll come with his Ofyevna?"
"No, he stayed on the wall and watched."
"How many wolf warriors were there, Lord?"
"Not many. 60 or 70. There wasn't time to count them, we just had to fight them." Later, much later, I learned that Skoll had been keeping his Ofyevna for the battle's end, saving their savagery for the slaughterous pursuit as we retreated. But Snorri's defeat had enraged them, and men who are under the influence of a sorcerer's potion are incapable of obeying orders. They are like hounds smelling blood. They just want to fight. And so the Ofyevna had simply charged through the open gate. No one ordered that charge. Skoll probably did not want it, but he was evidently content to let his crazed warriors make their headlong assault, knowing that even if his Ofyevna went down to a bloody defeat, that would not change the battle's outcome.
"But surely he didn't want to lose them?"
Father Selwyn asked me, puzzled.
"You can't control the Ofyevna," I tried to explain. "It's as if they're drunk. They believe they can fly, they believe they're invulnerable, and believe me, such men can do an astonishing amount of killing before you put them down. They're usually the youngest hotheads, men who want reputation, men who want to boast in the mead hall of their exploits. Skoll probably didn't want to lose them, but it would only add to his reputation if they panicked us. I remember looking at him as they charged, and he was laughing."
Skoll was laughing, and his men up on the walls were cheering. This was a spectacle. A crazed charge by drugged warriors, a revenge for Snorri's defeat. Not every man who came towards us was an Ofyevin. Some other young men had joined the madness. There were probably about 100 warriors altogether, most of them in the grey cloaks, though some were bare-chested, and many of them came without either shields or helmets. They believed they could not be harmed because the henbane had given them the courage of the insane. And we made the shield wall, which meant it was discipline against madness. Rorik had brought me a dead man's shield, and I tried to stand in the front rank, But Finan unceremoniously pushed me to the third rank.
"You're not recovered, Lord."
He did the same to see Trigger, who was unable to hold a shield, then turned to look at the approaching men.
"Shields up!" he shouted. "And you, spears!"
The charging men screamed. I had an impression of wild faces, unbound hair, mouths open, fierce eyes, long swords, and then the leading men leapt at us. Was it because they believed they could fly? They leapt as if to jump over the front rank and were met by spears. I saw a savage-faced man screaming at us, jumping at the men in front of me, and Beanoth just lifted his spear and impaled the Norseman. The man, still screaming as blood appeared in his mouth, slid down the long shaft to be met by a sword cut that ended the scream abruptly. Another Ulfhedinn, wielding an axe, beat down two of our front rank, screamed his triumph, and waded into the second rank where three men hacked him to death with swords and axes. He was not the only man to break the wall, but those crazed warriors who threw themselves at our shields had no one to support them. Sheer impetuosity split our shield wall in places, but the wall closed up relentlessly. Then it went forward. Finan was bellowing the order,
"Forward! Forward!"
And still the Ulfhednar came, slamming into us, screeching and flailing. And still we went forward, step by step, slipping on blood-slicked grass. A bare-chested man held an axe at our wall, and the big blade split a shield in two, and the man followed with no weapon but his hands, clawing at Beanoth, whose shield was splintered, and my son killed him with a vicious upwards thrust of his sea-axe.
"Close up!" Finan shouted. "Close up! Keep going!"
Men stepped over the blood-laced bodies of the dead, and still the wolf warriors fought. It usually took two men to defeat each, one man to take the attack of axe, sword, or spear on his shield, and the other to kill. Some of our men seemed infected by the madness of the Ulfhednar. I saw Redbad break out of the front rank and slam an axe down on a charging man, splitting his skull in a mist of blood and brains. My son hauled Redbad back. The shields touched, and the wall went forward again. Imar Hergilsson, who I had taken care to keep in the rearward rank, because he was not as well trained as most of my men, had somehow worked his way to the front and was screaming defiance. I saw him slice down with his sword, saw him kill a second man, and saw the battle joy on his young face. Seatrigger's men, who had been facing the ramparts where Svart had died, were running to join us now. We were advancing down the long wall between the western and northern towers, driving back the survivors of the mad, brave charge. Not all the enemy were mad, and some lost their bravery. They saw their companions die. They smelled the blood and shit of dying men. They saw the grim wall of shields coming, a wall glinting with spears and swords. The right-hand end of that wall was being assailed by spears thrown from the ramparts, and I shouted for Cuthwulf,
"Use your arrows on them!"
I called, pointing at the men throwing the spears.
"All of the arrows, Lord."
"All of them."
I had realized that we had no chance of overcoming the fort's walls. There were too many defenders. Even if the northern corner was easier to approach, we would still face a rampart packed with warriors. We would have to be content with this small victory over Skoll's vaunted Ulfhednar, though once they were killed, it would be our turn to face the slaughterers. Our shield wall advanced inexorably, step by slow step, to drive Skoll's men back, and Skoll, it seemed, decided enough was enough, because a horn sounded urgently from the ramparts, a signal to recall the surviving Ulfhednar. Most of the wolf warriors ignored it, too crazed to abandon the fight, and too crazed to obey an order, and so they kept trying to break our wall, kept stabbing and screaming, and the screams turned to cries of agony as they were cut down. But some few turned to retreat, and most of the young men who had joined the charge of the Ulfhednar also obeyed the summons. They ran back to the gate. and it was closed. Men beat on the gate. It did not open. Maybe half the men who had charged us were now bunched at the entrance, screaming at its defenders to let them in. My son saw the opportunity before anyone else and shouted, "Kill them! Kill them!" He broke out of the shield wall and, followed by his closest companions, charged at the gate. The mad bravery of the Ofjevna can turn to terrified panic in a heartbeat. Men who a moment before had thought themselves unbeatable were suddenly turned into sobbing, desperate fugitives. They beat at the gate. They screamed for it to be opened. They screamed even more when my battle-maddened men began their slaughter on the causeway that crossed the ditches. I was hurrying after them. All of us were going towards that gate. And I looked above the arch to the fighting platform, where I expected to see Skull's men hurling spears into our ranks. And instead I saw the eagle. And men fighting.
"Almighty God, Lord and Ruler, gave them wondrous aid. The valiant heroes with their precious swords then hacked a bloody passage through the host of foemen. They split the shields, cut through their shield wall."
"Almighty God?" I asked.
"The Archbishop asked for the poem, Lord,"
Father Selwyn said very primly, "and I don't think he'd be pleased if I gave the credit to Odin." I grunted. "I suppose not. But you don't even mention the eagle."
"I do, Lord,"
he protested, then leafed back through the pages.
"There, the white-tailed eagle—"
"Not the bird," I said, "the flag.
The spread eagle, Berg's banner."
"Was that important, Lord?"
"Of course it's important. Didn't you even talk to Berg, or to his brothers?"
"No, Lord."
"The flag was flying over the shut gate," I said, "and all three brothers were there."
"You should talk to the oldest, he's a poet."
"Is he, Lord?"
The young priest sounded distant, as if he did not like hearing about a rival poet. "He's called Egil," I said. "He's a skald and a fighter and something of a sorcerer, too. He's a remarkable man."
"He certainly sounds so, Lord,"
the priest said, still distant.
"You say the flag was over the gate?"
"Berg was waving it." The gods do play with us. And like children, they love surprising us. I could almost hear their delighted laughter when I saw Berg desperately waving his precious flag. I had no idea what it meant at that moment. For a heartbeat, I even thought he'd joined Skull's forces. But then saw that the men around Berg, those men high on the platform above the gate, were throwing spears at the lower ramparts. They were throwing spears at Skull's men, not at us. And at that moment I knew the curse was lifted. The pain in my head and the ache in my thigh did not matter, because Berg's banner, the spread eagle banner of the Skallagrimir family, was flying over Heber. When Berg had vanished at the battle's opening, the banner had disappeared with him, and I had feared he was dead or a captive, but the truth was much stranger. The gods loved Berg, which made it odd to remember that when I had saved him from death on a Welsh beach, I had promised King Hywel I would let the Christians try to convert him. I had kept that promise, but Berg had never succumbed to their persuasion, and ever since the gods had rewarded him. Berg was lucky. And never more so than on that day at Heber. He had thought he was dead when the first surprise attack came from the fog, and he was almost overwhelmed by Skull's men.
"I knew I couldn't reach you, Lord,"
he told me after the battle,
"so I ran down into the valley. I was going to keep running, but heard my name being called."
"It was your brother?"
"Both brothers, Lord."
Berg had two elder brothers, Egil and Thorulf, who, on the death of their father, had sent their younger brother to sail with a Viking crew so he could learn the business of raiding. An education that had ended on the beach where I had discovered him. The older brothers, in the meantime, made farms on Snaeland. that raw island of ice and fire in the stormy waters of the Northern Ocean. And it was there that they heard stories of a new Norse kingdom being carved from the coastal lands of Western Britain. And so, leaving their families in Snaeland, they had sailed with 2 ships and 72 men.
"They only arrived a fortnight ago, Lord,"
Berg told me. "They want to settle here.
Skoll promised them wealth and land, so if they find good land, yes, Lord, I think they might bring their women too."
I was not surprised. I had been to Snaeland, and life there was hard. The winters were cruel, and rich enemies were few, which meant plunder was scarce. And so the Skallagrimason brothers were restless, bored, eager for the sea and for new lands. Skoll had beckoned. They had come. And at Hebra they had found their younger brother.
"And you persuaded them they were fighting for the wrong side?"
"Yes, Lord," Berg said. "But I think what really persuaded them was Snorri's defeat. Egil said that was a sign from the gods."
He hesitated, plainly about to add something, then decided it was best left unsaid. I guessed what he was reluctant to say.
"And you promised your brothers I'd give them land and wealth if they fought for me?"
He had blushed.
"I just said you were generous, Lord."
Egil Skallagrimason's men had been charged with defending the northern section of the wall, from the gate to the tower, and they had let the Ulfhyrnar loose by opening the gate after Snorri's defeat.
"If the wolfmen defeat your lord Uhtred,"
Egil had told Berg,
"we will know what the gods want."
And it had become clear that the gods did not want the Ulfhyrnar to win. And so Egil had shut the gate and kept it barred as my son's men hacked and speared their way through the survivors of the crazed charge. Skoll realized too late what was happening, but as soon as he understood that Egil's men had turned on him, he began the fight I had seen on the ramparts. And while Egil fought off Skoll's men, Thorolf Skallagrimason opened the gate to mine. We were inside Hebr. My son was first. His men pulled away the bodies that blocked the gate, then helped to hold the great gates open before bursting into the fortress. We followed, climbing over the Ulfhyrnar corpses that were strewn on the causeway, then going into the narrow lanes between the Roman barracks. I could hear women screaming, children crying, dogs barking, and horses whinnying. The barracks still mostly had stone walls, though the walls were much patched with timber, and all were now roofed with turf rather than tiles. Some were being used as stables, others were sleeping quarters. One was a storehouse of grain, another was heaped with silver ingots, and we now fought past all the buildings and through some, though Seatrigger, his left arm lamed, and I, with my blurred sight and wounded leg, could not keep up with the younger men, who were surging through the alleys and screaming like fiends as they cut down an enemy who had never expected us to pierce their defences. I found one of Skoll's men dying in a doorway. His guts spilled onto horse dung.
"Lord, Lord,"
he called to me, and I saw that his sword, a cheap blade, had fallen from his hand. I edged it nearer him with my foot, and his hand closed around the hilt.
"Thank you, Lord,"
he said. Oswy, coming behind me, slashed his sword across the man's throat. "He was dying," I said.
"That's 7, Lord."
Oswy had not heard me, and would not have cared if he had. He ran past me, eager for his 8th victim.
"Lay down your weapons,"
Seatrigger shouted, and some of his men took up the shout. Berg's brothers and their Snaelanders had stayed by the gate, anxious not to be mistaken for Skoll's men by our vengeful warriors. Discipline had let our men defeat the Ulfhyrnar, but that order now vanished in a horror of slaying. Our men filled the alleys with rivers of blood. I smelled the stink of gore. I saw men hacking at corpses, screaming as if they were themselves Ulfhyrnar. I called on them to make shield walls, to defend themselves against a desperate, panicked enemy, but they were men who had expected to die, and they took revenge for that despair by killing in a fury. Most of Skoll's warriors were still on the fighting platforms of the ramparts, above the slaughter in the fort.